It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, December 3rd, 2023. I'm Jared Halpern. Americans are spending a lot more than a few years ago, but the Biden administration says inflation is easing.
We have to take the lessons we learned from that episode of seriously non-resilient supply chains and make sure that they stay unsnarled.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The Fox News great red versus blue state debate went down between California Governor Gavin Newsom and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis this past week.
He needs volume. He needs a bump. He needs to get back in the game. He's going in the wrong direction in the presidential. And his opponent used that against him in various times throughout the debate.
California's governor insists he's not running for president, at least not now.
Gavin Newsom is not running for president. Ron DeSantis will not be the nominee, and I agree with my governor that Ron DeSantis will be backing Trump.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. In all the chaotic events that can dominate a president's time in office, there is a constant: concerns about the economy. Simply, if Americans feel good about what they're bringing in and what things cost, approval ratings for an administration generally reflect that. The converse is just as simple. If you worry about the amount coming in isn't keeping pace with the cost of basic needs, well, you'll have approval ratings similar to what President Biden is facing right now. It's why in nearly every event he does, whether it's here in D.C. or on the road like this past week in Colorado, the president's trying to assure Americans things are looking up.
We're invested in America. We're invested in Americans. And it's working.
Earlier in the week, President Biden convened the first meeting of a new group, the White House Council on Supply Chain Resilience.
On Thanksgiving 2 years ago, 100 container ships were waiting in dock in the ports. They were lined up 100 long out into the ocean. This year, there were less than 10, meaning that today, as folks start their holiday shopping, shelves are stocked.
Certainly, supply and demand tells us one way to keep prices low is to ensure plenty of inventory. And that's why the supply chain is so important. But it's not just a matter of making sure ships can get here. It's also a question of where those ships and where the goods they carry are from. I spoke about that with the chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Jared Bernstein, who also serves on the new Supply Chain Council.
Very soon after we got here, so in might have been February of 21 or March, the president set up something called the Supply Chain Disruption Task Force. I remember it because I was an active card-carrying member. And you may recall, if you follow this stuff, that's when we were all obsessing over dwell time, how long containers were spending in ports, and where there was a traffic jam in the ports of Long Beach in LA. And that task force got to work and was very successful in early unsnarling of the supply chain. And there's very good data showing how much not only supply chains have improved, but how important that improvement has been for lowering inflation, for disinflation, especially of goods, of course. And so you might say, well, isn't that work behind you? But no, we have to take the lessons we learned from that episode of seriously non-resilient supply chains and make sure that they stay unsnarled, make sure that all the agencies are working to ensure that they have ongoing supply chain the supply chains they face, so HHS in terms of medicines, are smooth and unsnarled. And so we're going to build on what we've learned, build on what we've done to maintain the resiliency that we've helped to implement.
The HHS component of this seems really important, right, given what we learned in COVID. How much of these medications that we rely on are being manufactured overseas?
I don't have a percentage because there's so many different medications. And, you know, overseas covers a lot. So what you want to be mindful of is geopolitical conflicts and pressures that your supply chain can embed in ways that could be destructive and threaten our security, whether it's national security or in this case health security. So think about China in this regard. So you want to diversify away from areas like that, and we have in the past depended on China for lots of our prescription drugs. So this is what comes under the rubric of friendshoring, making sure that you're still trading, because nobody's talking about complete domestic supply of everything, but you're onshoring where you can and you're friendshoring where you need to.
So when you say friendshoring, that's making sure that the countries that we rely on are not countries who could like hold this over our heads.
Yeah, so exactly.
Our trade, like NATO countries or countries that we have really good trade relationships with.
Exactly. Our trading partners are our friends, yes.
How much of inflation over the last 2 years, let's say, has been tied directly to the snafus in the supply chain?
It's funny you should ask that, because we published a blog post on exactly this yesterday, we've had about 80% of our disinflation coming from supply chain improvements. It's a little more complicated than that, because in the statistical analysis we did, this is a CEA blog that I commend to everyone. I mean, we've tried to write it in a way that it would be, understandable to any readers. You don't have to be an econometrician to get it. But we interacted supply and demand. So what does that mean? Supply chains became snarled because of COVID, and this is a global thing, just like the inflation was global. Supply chains became snarled at a time when demand for manufactured goods was very strong. In part, this was because people were no longer interacting with in-person services and they had extra savings, in part because they were spending more time at home and they wanted to fix up the home office and so on. And so the interaction of snarled supply chains and strong demand led to a global inflation that was, high here, but high in all other advanced economies. And in fact, it's come down more here than it has there. We've had more disinflation than those other countries, and that's been good to see. And as we show, that relates to a big chunk of that. The majority relates to improvements in the chains.
You keep using this phrase disinflation. That's a little bit different than deflation, right? Because we got the PCE report yesterday that said that inflation was down like 3.5%, I think, from a year ago, or is at 3.5%. But that's still up, right, month to month.
Well, in fact, month to month, it wasn't up. Month to month, it was zero. So it was flat. But yes, there's a difference between disinflation, which means slower inflation. So economy-wide, we've had about 6 percentage points of disinflation. Inflation peaked a little bit above 9%. Last seen, it was 3.2%. So that's a 65% decline in the rate of inflation, but that's slower inflation. Where we've seen deflation, which means falling prices, not falling inflation, but falling prices, where we've seen deflation is in some goods where you really saw price spikes. So used cars, eggs, some other dairy products. Airline fares are an interesting one, because airline fares are down, I think, 13% over the past year. They're actually lower than they were pre-pandemic. So there we've seen some really, I think, useful disinflation for people who are traveling around and want to get a little breathing room there.
What's the goal here? I mean, 3.5% is under 4%. I know 4%.
By the way, yesterday, you're citing
like
core
standard.
Inflation. You're citing core inflation. Yesterday, I believe the year-over-year inflation was 3%, not 3.5. That's for the headline. Yeah.
But what is the goal? I mean, is it to kind of have prices continue? I mean, you want some inflation, or do you want negative inflation? What are you trying to?
Okay, so that's a more complicated question than it sounds in the following sense. The institution that sets an inflation target is not the administration or the White House. It's the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve has an inflation target, and that's their work. We stay out of their knitting. From our perspective, the goal, as the president talks about it every time he talks about the economy, is to give families more breathing room. Yes, we've enjoyed significant disinflation, and pretty remarkably from an economic perspective, we've done so without giving up much at all on the unemployment rate side. Implicitly, you and I have already talked about that, because most of the improvement in inflation has been from normalization of supply chains. We haven't had to give up a lot on the labor market side. We still have very strong GDP. It grew 5% in the third quarter. That's blockbuster growth. We've had an unemployment rate below 4% for 21 months in a row, millions of jobs. So we've kept a tight labor market while having more disinflation. But, you know, obviously, if you listen to people's sentiments about this, they still need more breathing room. And so what the president talks about is, in terms of targets, is continuing to maintain a great economy, a strong labor market, rising real wages, while putting downward pressure on inflation and helping people with costs, directly helping people with costs, getting rid of junk fees, making sure that if you're going to a concert or checking into a hotel or renting a car, you're not getting gouged, you're not getting hit by a junk fee, making sure that if you're buying insulin, you're paying $35 a month, that's in the IRA, making sure that Medicare can bargain for lower prescription drug costs, helping people directly lower costs and fighting to keep inflation down as best we can. That's the goal.
And I'm glad you mentioned it, because that was where I was going to lead this, right? Because obviously economy or economics is one thing, and the political perception is quite another. And obviously you work in the White House, the political perception matters a great deal. You saw, I'm sure, this report from the Senate earlier this week that Americans are spending about $11,000 more just to maintain the same standard of living from January 2021. That's a lot, right? I mean, is there sort of equivalent with how that analysis was done from the Joint Economic Committee?
Yeah, I think that was a flawed piece of work that doesn't reflect people's experiences at all. In fact, if you look at, you know, one of the things they're doing there is they're taking the growth in inflation over a bunch of years and comparing it to costs without factoring in income at all or wage growth at all. Now, so let me put it this way. If you look at the increase in inflation since 2019, of course, it's come down a lot over the last year, but it's up, 19%, I think, since 2019. Actually, if you look at real disposable income, that is people's incomes after taxes, controlling for inflation, it's up 24%. So if you just look at the price side, you're going to miss gains that people have made on the income side. And in fact, disposable income, real wages, net worth, all of those are up and consistently up such that people's buying power is improving. Now, our work is not done. That 11,400 is a nonsense number, but that doesn't mean that people are feeling great. We've got more work to do. And the way we do that is to maintain the strong job market, cut costs where we can, take action against junk fees, make sure that people can afford the healthcare they need by lowering prescription drug costs, getting in there and, you know, fighting for lower costs, fighting for lower profit margins, as you've heard the president do lately, while we maintain the current wage and income growth. I think that's the way forward. And we're on the right path, but we have to do more of that. I think when it comes to Republicans, since you brought them into the mix here, we should really compare what I've just described with, from what I can see, a policy agenda which looks like it's focused on cutting taxes for the most wealthy, giving big breaks to big pharma as we're pushing the other way, trying to lower prescription costs, and enabling rich people to rip off the IRS. And so I think if you look at what we're trying to do versus what the folks who published this incorrect study are trying to do, you come to a pretty different conclusion.
Let me finish with this, because I know I saw this and I know the president's working on trying to get more Americans and really the entire market to shift more towards electric vehicles. At the same time, China controls an awful lot of those critical minerals needed for the batteries. There is this new rule that's expected to go in place that would maybe ratchet back some of those federal tax credits that folks get for EVs. How do you balance that, right? How do you balance kind of the need to wean industries away from maybe hostile actors or nefarious actors, and at the same time, not have that drive up cost for consumers?
Well, one very direct way we do that is by providing a subsidy of $7,500 for people who buy electric vehicles, and that makes them cost competitive. While that subsidy is in place, we provide a lot of incentives for domestic production of precisely these components. And I'm sure you've seen, if you follow this, I think the latest number I saw was $600 billion of private capital building manufacturing facilities in this country in precisely this space: electric vehicles, battery production, clean energy production. These create construction jobs in building all those factories, and of course, longer-term jobs once those factories are up and running. But along with jobs, they're creating domestic production in precisely this space, so that we can meet the criteria set out in the legislation that you described for you know, domestic content requirements. Now, these domestic content requirements are phased in so that these companies have time to stand up. And we have to kind of walk and chew gum here. We have to build the airplane as we're flying it, make sure that we're building this capacity while we're still importing critical minerals that we need to do this, you know, in the meantime, while we're standing up more domestic production. But that's the plan. And, you know, quite the extent to which it's being executed looks pretty remarkable to me.
It'll be something that we continue to follow. Obviously, we are following the economy closely. It is a top priority for the president as well, and it's a top priority for voters. So we'll have a lot more to talk about in the months and years ahead. Jared, appreciate the time as always.
Jared, great to talk to you.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fox News host Sean Hannity got California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom to agree to a debate with Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, and it was a slugfest. It began with DeSantis saying California's failing due to Newsom's leftist policies.
He's very good at spinning these tales. He's good at being slick and slippery. He'll tell a blizzard of lies to be able to try to mask the failures.
Newsom hit back, explaining what he saw as his role on that debate stage.
I'm here to tell the truth about the Biden-Harris record and also compare and contrast Ron DeSantis's record and the Republican Party's record as a point of contrast that's as different as daylight and darkness. You want to bring us back to a pre-1960s world, America in reverse.
At one point, Hannity asked Newsom if Biden was paying him. Newsom gestured at DeSantis.
I thought this was state versus state.
No, but it's about the United States of America. I thought this guy was running for president of the United States.
You just won't admit it.
Newsom insists he is not. Everything from taxes, people leaving California, homelessness, crime, education, immigration, it was all on the table. But did it help or hurt DeSantis, who is actively running for president and is far behind former President Trump as Nikki Haley surges in the polls?
Yeah, you know, there's home court advantage, obviously. You know, it's more meaningful for him, presumably, right, than it is for his debating opponent.
Francis Suarez is the mayor of Miami, Florida, and was a Republican presidential candidate who dropped out earlier this year.
He needs volume. He needs a bump. He needs to get back in the game. He's going in the wrong direction in the presidential. And his opponent used that against him in various times throughout the debate. Obviously, I believe that the facts, you know, and Miami's a big part of what he would call the Florida blueprint. We call it the Miami miracle, you know, where we've lowered taxes to the lowest level ever. We're about to finish the year with the lowest homicide rate in history. We grew 14%. And we have the highest wage growth in America. So the biggest city in the state of Florida is thriving. And that is very different from what's happening in California. San Francisco suffering, LA suffering. And my governor made that point over and over and over again. Obviously, he's not, I mean, I wouldn't say that he's as slick a debater as the governor from California, but he acknowledged that at the beginning. In fact, it was like,
you use the word slick. DeSantis actually kept saying that every time Newsom came back at him, he was slick. That was like his line.
Yeah, and I think it was a smart tactic because what he was doing was he was setting up the audience to understand, look, this guy's going to try to nuance his way out of these bad facts. And he's a good debater, right? So he's already kind of prompting the audience to know this is what the guy's strategy is going to be. And he's also kind of signaling, look, I'm not as slick, you know, I'm not as good a debater in the classic sense. I'm not going to be
right, lower the expectations, so right?
Yeah. Which I think was smart. I think that was a smart tactic on his part. You know, and he's kind of like a bulldog, you know, he's kind of like, he just kind of hammers home the facts. He does this new thing, which I think his debate partners have taught him to do because he has this issue with connecting and personalizing. So he starts with these stories. And you've noticed this in the debates that he's constantly talking about, a story of a specific individual, either in the specific case or in the abstract. He'll say, I've heard from this person. And then he used a story, which I thought was very effective, which was the story of this person who he said had left California for X reason, Y reason, and Z reason. And then he said, and by the way, it's your father-in-law, you know,
right.
which I thought was super effective.
Tell me then, though, Mayor, about, because, you know, Sean Hannity's putting up these stats and numbers about homelessness and outbound migration and crime and all these different things. And to your point, you know, Newsom would sort of reframe things. But the way he did it was to say, like, look, OK, California's crime rate is higher, but Florida's murder rate is higher on taxes. California has higher taxes. Newsom said, well, actually, Florida has a higher regressive tax, meaning lower income folks pay more of their money than what. So do you think any of that landed? I mean, were those adequate points?
It's hard to say because I think you have to think of the audience, right? And if the audience are Fox News's regular viewers, and you know, I don't know what the breakdown is, you know, of the ratings yet. If it's Fox News regular viewers, I would say that they would be skeptical to believe Newsom's nuanced arguments over the statistics that, by the way, it's not just what Governor DeSantis was saying, but it's what was up on the board, right?
Right.
What was researched and what was shown to be supported by the evidence, right? So, like, for example, on murders, I can tell you in Miami, you notice that he did not say Miami, Gavin Newsom. He said Orlando. He said
Jacksonville, Tampa, yeah.
He never said Miami. And the reason why he never said Miami is because we're on the precipice of having the lowest homicide rate in recorded history. We started recording homicides in 1947. We had 32 in 1947. Right now, year to date, we have 25. We would be the seventh safest city of our size in the country on a per capita basis if we were to end the year with the number that we have now. So, the thing with these things is that, you know, we live in a world now where the facts are so hard to determine, right? There's so much lack of confidence in the media generally, and I'm not saying Fox, I'm saying in the media generally, and this narrative of fake news, you know, and these debates, it just seems like people are just going back and forth, and it's sometimes it's hard to understand. What I would love to see is what would the reason why I would like to see this is because obviously a lot of times presidential races come down to independent voters. You know, it would be interesting to see what independent voters, how they felt, because obviously I think Republicans would have largely felt that DeSantis did better, and Democrats, because he's articulating Democrats' vision, would probably largely believe that, that Newsom did better. But it would be interesting to see how independents felt after last night's debate.
I'll tell our polling division you said that. So, but yeah. Newsom seemed to rile up his fans, right? With he made some comments like, DeSantis and I have something in common. Neither of us will be the 2024 nominee. And he said, you know, how's it going, Ron, when you're 41 points down in your state? It sounded like Newsom was doing a couple of things, and one of them was being a Biden surrogate to a certain extent.
He was, but you know what? He was also being, at some level, a Trump surrogate, right? Because he kept saying, you know, you're losing in your state to the former president by 40 points. He tried to call him out on a COVID hypocrisy at the beginning, where, you know, Ron supported lockdowns like everybody else and wore masks like everybody else, and then sort of changed on that. Those are Trump talking points. If you listen to what Trump has been saying on the campaign trail, he's parroting Trump. And then he threw Nikki Haley in his face. He says, why don't you just drop out and endorse Nikki Haley? Right. So he was kind of interestingly using Trump and Haley against DeSantis, and sort of using the whole presidential race against DeSantis. I think what DeSantis tried to do at the beginning, and I think did it a little bit at the end, was to try to unmask Newsom and say, hey, look, you're the one that's really running for president. Let's get this. Mm-hmm. Let's be clear about this. Right. This is not, you know, you don't care about Kamala or however you pronounce her name. What you care about is running for this shadow election, and right. that's and you know, I don't think him trying to correct DeSantis on how to pronounce a vice president's name is really something that's going to resonate.
Okay, finally, Mayor, is Gavin Newsom right? Is Trump going to be the nominee?
The way you have to look at this, and I think the way everybody's looking at this, is we have a month until the Iowa caucus.
Right
now, Trump is in a dominant position, 30 points up. Did yesterday do anything to change that? I think the consensus so far that I've read is no. The second part is, if he wins Iowa by 30 points and he wins New Hampshire by 20, 25 points, and then wins in South Carolina, that kind of knocks Nikki Haley out, because she presumably, you know, would be the strongest candidate in South Carolina, right? I mean, that's her home state. So if she loses South Carolina, Super Tuesday is right after that, where Florida is a participant, and Trump is up by 40 points. So from an electoral perspective, Trump is in a dominant position. Obviously, he has four criminal trials that he has to contend with. And I think that is the, you know, sort of the wild card in this whole thing. So what happens if he gets indicted? I mean, if he gets convicted, right? Like, what is the next step, right? Is he allowed to stay in the race? Or does he go to jail? Can he run from jail? Can a president be elected and be in jail? I mean, these are questions that I no one's talking about, right? Which is weird, because, I mean, they're very logical questions to ask when someone is about to face a criminal trial.
Maybe we're all just in denial. It's still 2023, Mayor.
I think you're right about that.
Let us get to 2024. Let us get through the holidays.
Sure. I got you. I'm with you. It's a little it's a lot to chew on.
Yeah, but you know what? That's good. And you know what? You do raise a lot of questions, and I do know there's been some addressing of those. But you're right. Like, it will. I think on January 3rd we'll start talking more about all of that as we into this and prep for it. Okay. Well, Mayor Francis Suarez of Miami, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
During the debate, Hannity laid out data showing California with generally a higher crime rate, more homelessness, more people leaving California to go to places like Florida. Governor Newsom was asked to defend the data, but he pointed out what he saw in the numbers in an effort to paint Florida as the one with the problems. Democratic strategist and Fox News contributor Leslie Marshall agreed with the tactics.
It may not be the most eloquent way to say it, but I saw on Twitter somebody that said, Ron DeSantis just had Gavin Newsom's shoes surgically removed from his butt. And really, that's what I thought. Now, I know there are going to be conservatives that disagree, although I went out after the debate with some girlfriends, do that little weekly girls night out thing with different girlfriends. And some of them were Republicans, and some of them aren't really fans of Ron DeSantis, even though they're Republicans. And I mean, they're all over the map, whether they're Trump or they're, you know, Haley, or they don't like anybody, you know, that kind of thing, or they don't like Biden, or they'd rather have Biden, you know, whatever. But they just didn't feel that he came off strong, or that he helped himself. And
that DeSantis didn't help himself?
Correct. I didn't think DeSantis helped himself at all. No. And I think what's interesting is there are a lot of people on the right who do what I do, who would say that in Florida, they love Ron DeSantis. But as my governor, Gavin Newsom, pointed out, he's 41 points down in his own state. So they don't love him that much, or they don't love him for a national position, but perhaps just as their governor.
Well, let me ask you, Leslie, because, you know, there was this insistence from Governor Newsom that people are actually moving back to California. And it is true that there are some moving back, but the math does show that more have moved to Florida than have left Florida for California. Instead of addressing that, like, I mean, the state has lost a congressional seat based on the numbers, even before COVID. He said, California has no peer. I'm a California girl born and raised. LA will always be my home. But that sounded like dismissive. Like, we're too big and great. We don't even have to answer for the middle class leaving. I know people who have left. It is real. I'm sure you do, too.
I know people that have left. But when you look at the numbers, I don't know what numbers you're looking at. We have almost as many people coming, and ironically, from Texas, that are coming to California. And I would agree with the governor that we don't have a peer. And I don't say that from sitting in a high position. I'm a Boston girl who's a transplanted Californian, different than you. But I have to say there are many reasons for that. I can't stand, there are a number of things. First of all, you know, Ronald Reagan was a Republican, and he was governor of the state of California. And when Ronald Reagan was president, became president, elected president, gas prices were highest in California. Homelessness was highest in California. One of the reasons for that is California has a much higher cost of living So you have big oil that get away, as they do if you look throughout the country. In the more affluent areas, gas prices tend to be higher. And that's in the world as well. Look at London, for example. In addition to that, we have the highest population in the United States of America. And we also have the highest rental and real estate prices. And that certainly has contributed to homelessness, especially during and post pandemic.
But isn't Leslie, isn't that about government? Government can change that. That's about bureaucracy to a certain extent.
No, you can't. Government cannot dictate what the private sector does. Gavin Newsom has wanted to do for years, as many Democrats have, not just here in California, but what they do in London. I'm going to use that as an example. My best friend lives there. He used to spend every summer there before I had kids. And one of the things that they do in London is when they build a building, a certain percentage, 5 or 10%, have to be low income. Now, of course, they use different materials. You know, the back of the building, you don't have the good views necessarily for rentals or for purchase. And that has not been able to go over because, you know, government can only do so much, whether it's on a state level or a federal level. You do have a private sector that the government can't touch in certain areas. And when I talk also about.
But there are developers, Leslie, there are people, and we can get into it, but there are people who've run for governor on the Republican side who've even complained about how difficult it is to build housing in California. You have to deal with coastal commissions and CEQA. And I mean, there are so many more regulations when it comes to building anything and doing anything in California than in plenty of other states.
Yeah, but you know what bothers me sitting here in California is most of the people complaining about California don't live here, don't visit here. And my attitude is don't visit here and don't live here. When somebody runs for president, to look at what happened in their state to me is ridiculous. And let me give you an example. OK, Joe Biden comes from Delaware. Did we look at Delaware and what happened in Delaware when he ran for president? No. Why? Or Ronald
because
Reagan.
Delaware. Delaware.
No. People love to pick on California because we're the biggest, we're the sixth largest economy in the world, and we have a lot of liberals here. And so conservatives love to, you know, pick on California. But the reality is when somebody runs for president, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, they're not going to be able to run 50 state nation the way they ran their state. There's a different structure of government. And certainly 50 states is different than one state. So people can sit there and they can argue, oh, California this or Florida that. But like my governor says, neither one of these men will be the nominee in 2024. Mm. I have people all over the internet, and I would somewhat agree, say, what was this debate about? Gavin Newsom is not running for president. Ron DeSantis will not be the nominee. And I agree with my governor that Ron DeSantis will be backing Trump, you know, in a few weeks. I agree with his predictions. So it was political theater, obviously showing a picture of feces.
That's real. It might be political theater to a certain extent, but that is real. Like we
but
know
it doesn't affect, it does not affect the voters' decisions on who they're going to vote for. And you can look at debate after debate after debate after debate. Examples, I'll give you two. John Kerry, George Bush. All three debates, almost all the polls show Kerry winning. Who won the presidency? George Bush. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Most polls favored Hillary Clinton. All three debates. Who won the presidency? Donald Trump. Endorsements and debates do not garner votes. Maybe a few, but not enough. At the end of the day, conservatives looked at DeSantis as being stronger. Progressives and liberals looked at Newsom as being stronger. And just like, you know, I've always said, it is a numbers game. It is not about a debate. It is about the Electoral College. And the way this country is, based on the numbers right now, Joe Biden would be president. And the reason for that is just the numbers. Politics and winning a seat, whether it's gubernatorial, whether it's a state legislature seat, a federal legislature seat, or the presidency, is based on numbers. And those numbers are very tight. They have been for the past few general elections, and they will be going forward until our country is not so divided. But pretty much, we have almost 50% left, 50% right. It comes down to five states and a slither of independent voters within those states that will determine the presidency. So not a debate on any network.
Okay, really quickly, Leslie. Newsom definitely came across as also not just a governor, but as a surrogate for the Biden administration. He wanted to make it very clear he's not running. It's not him. I think he's said it again that the next in line naturally is Kamala Harris, vice president. Are you still convinced that Newsom is not running, but he may be running in 2028?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's not. Look, you know, he is a fan of both the president and the vice president. And he is part of a United Democratic team who backs their president and their vice president, who backs their incumbents, just as Republicans do. And by quite frankly, just as parties, Democrat and Republican, should. So do I think he will run next time around? Absolutely. Is he running now? Absolutely not. He's made that clear. People can keep saying it and wishing it and wanting it. People said Hillary was going to run again. She's like, I'm not running again. And she didn't run again. I mean, right. Sometimes politicians are telling the truth.
Democratic strategist and Fox News contributor Leslie Marshall, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. This week, all senators get a classified briefing on Ukraine and Israel as they consider aid to both countries, and the vice president travels to Dubai along with dozens of lawmakers for COP28, the UN's climate negotiations event. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.